The gunshots echo through the silent night. Neighbours sit up in their armchairs, suddenly alert. Television volumes lowered, casting looks between one another. Then, the squeal of tyres, and several moments later, a girl screams. Something terrible has happened, and the truth is already actively being hidden. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 181, The Sabati Family Massacre. Holidays are almost here. Head off on your travels and let Ring's wide range of easy-to-install smart home security devices, including security cameras, video doorbells and alarms, stand guard over your property and valuables while you're away. All devices can be monitored via the Ring app, meaning you can easily confirm all is well simply by checking the live video feed on your phone or smart device. For more information on Ring devices, visit Takealot, Incredible Connection, and Hersh's. Ring. Keeping people close to what's important. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa. /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Audra Diaz Infante, Karen, Annette Fenta, and Joyful Mbokazi for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Minor offenders have been on my mind a lot lately. Whether it's just one of those, when you're looking for it, you'll see it, things or not. There seems to be a lot more cases moving through the court systems right now where the offenders were minors when they committed the crimes. And not just barely under 18 minor either, but 13, 14, 15-year-olds committing or being accused of, at this point, really serious crimes like acts of terrorism, rape, and murder. And with our Child Justice Act protecting the identity of many child offenders, I've often wondered about how many end up re-offending, and we just don't know about it. Until this case, I hadn't really wondered how many had gotten away with a crime as serious as murder without being caught, because surely a child couldn't be capable of pulling off a murder that was unsolvable, right? Right. In researching this case, I used several media articles, legal resources related to the Child Justice Act, and an episode of Heske Nuut's series Vlees en Bloed. So let's get into episode 181, the Sabati Family Massacre.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
The Sabati family were well known in Macau, northwest of Pretoria. Solomon Lucky Sabati and his wife Machepo had met and married in their 20s, and over the years had three children, two girls and a boy. The oldest girl, Shekhovatso, and her sister, Ontatile, were 6 years apart in age. And then, when Ontatile was 12, she'd become a middle child when her mom gave birth to little Quinton. In Macau, the Sabatis were a model family. Dad Lucky was a police officer at Hebron Police Station and also a businessman. He owned a small supermarket, a funeral parlor, and a money-lending business through which he employed about 10 members of the community. He was also a pastor at the local 12 Apostles Church, and the family could be seen in the pews every Sunday. Mom Machepo worked as a carer at a retirement home. The Sabati children were respected in the community too, and everyone said they were kind, friendly, obedient, and respectful. No one would really have expected anything else from the Sabati family, because although close-knit and loving, Lucky and Machepo were also strict, no-nonsense parents. Their parenting style didn't seem to be a major problem for any of their children, at least until Ontatile turned 13 and started high school. It was around this time that the girl met a new group of friends, and by all accounts, she experienced a bit of a going-off-the-rails situation, which is not uncommon for teenagers, of course. Lucky and Machepo were very concerned, though, and clamped down on the girl's free time and communication. She didn't take this well, and continued to spiral out of control. Extended family members and those in the community also noticed that Ontatile was being less respectful toward her parents, and the school noticed her behavior was declining rapidly. Her parents were called in on many occasions for issues at school, and Lucky and Machepo became increasingly concerned about her welfare and what they could do to get her back on the right track again. Whether they knew it or not at the time, Ontatile would later say that she'd started abusing substances while in high school, including alcohol and also experimenting with drugs. Her parents used the parenting techniques that had worked for them in the past, essentially punitive actions which stripped Ontatile of any excess spare time or freedom she had. In their minds, the less time she spent unoccupied or in the presence of these friends who seemed to be bad influences, the less chance she would have to get into trouble. Unfortunately, Ontatile did not see that her parents were trying to keep her safe. As many teenagers would, she felt stifled and persecuted, sure that her parents just didn't want her to be her own person. So, she continued to push back. Complicating this, of course, from a psychological perspective, would be the fact that Ontatile had lived as the youngest child for her whole life, and just as she was entering high school, she suddenly found her place in the family changing as her younger brother was born, and she became the middle child with a different role to play. While it may seem a small thing, it can be quite disconcerting for a child to suddenly find the place they knew to be theirs in the family filled by someone else, and There is, of course, the old adage of middle child syndrome. This is not in any way a real psychological diagnosis, but more a group of feelings associated with an experience, like imposter syndrome, for instance. It's something that many psychologists find cropping up in the adult lives of people who were the middle child. It's essentially characterized by the feeling that you're neglected or looked over by your parents and the rest of the family because you don't hold a so-called important enough position. In other words, you're not the oldest child or the youngest child. And a family's attentions may be focused on the experiences of what an older child is doing or the firsts of the younger child who often naturally needs more attention. As a result, the middle child may act up in negative ways, both as a child and as an adult, to get the attention they feel is lacking. While I don't put a ton of weight in this from a criminological perspective, everything adds up, right? Either way, as the school holidays neared in December 2016, the Sabati family were trying to focus on the good. The oldest child, Shekhafatso, was 21 years old, and she was pregnant with what would be Lucky and Machepo's first grandchild. Despite the initial surprise of the pregnancy, sooner than they'd expected from their oldest daughter, the parents had gotten used to the idea, and by December, Shekhafatso was just 1 month out from her due date, and everyone was getting excited for the birth. The youngest Sabati family member, Quinton, had just turned 3 and was about to become an uncle. And although many of the photographs around the time show Ontatile looking rather glum, where the rest of the family is smiling, everything seemed to be sort of on track. On the evening of the 6th of December 2016, the Sabati family sat down for dinner. The previous night, they'd had to throw out their dinner and eat sandwiches, because when Machepo had dished up the food and tasted it, she tasted a strange bitterness and was concerned that there was something wrong with the meat she'd used to cook. Rather than risk getting the whole family sick with food poisoning, she'd binned the whole lot, and they'd had to settle for a quickly assembled substitute. So, on that night, they all tucked into their dinner with vigour, and as soon as they were finished, Ontatile started her designated chore of washing up the dishes. Around 10:30 p.m., she finished up the last of the plates and pots and walked outside to throw the washing up water down the drain. Minutes later, neighbours said they heard gunshots. Ontatile would later tell police officers she'd heard them too, and without thinking, she'd run back inside to see what was going on. There, she'd come across a terrifying nightmare at play. Her father, seated on the couch after his meal, had been shot several times by 2 intruders, one of whom was armed. Her mother, too, lay nearby. A bullet to her head had ended her life almost immediately. Shekhafatso lay sprawled in the hallway. She seemed to have run from her bedroom to see what was happening. She lay curled up on her side, her arm cast over her pregnant belly, a last-ditch attempt, perhaps, to protect the baby inside her, as the intruders fired bullets into her body too. Police would later find 3-year-old Quinton in his bedroom. The intruders had not spared him either. He'd received a single gunshot wound to the head, which had immediately ended his young life. Neighbours would later recall hearing the squealing of tyres and the Sabati's gate slamming closed. The intruders had stolen Lucky's Chrysler Voyager and fled into the night. Then they heard Ontatile screaming. As they rushed out of their house to see if they could help, the girl limped toward them, blood streaming from her leg. Everything happened quickly after that. Police descended on the Sabati home, a fellow police officer's family being slaughtered in their house was a case they all wanted solved immediately. Ontatile was rushed to the hospital for treatment. An officer accompanied her to get her initial statements as the ambulance drove. She spoke of two intruders. She didn't recognize the men, she said, had never seen them before. As news began to spread through the family and the community, people arrived at the family home, standing just outside the gates while forensics officers collected evidence, and the four bodies were removed. Lucky had been a father figure to many of the young men in his family and community, and those present would later speak of the heartbreak of seeing groups of men dropping to their knees and sobbing as the bodies of the Sabati family were wheeled to the pathology van, covered in white sheets. Later, after the house was cleared by police and released back to the family, Ontatile arrived back home. She'd only suffered a flesh wound to her thigh and had asked to be released so she could mourn with her family. The girl stood out in the room of grieving loved ones. Her eyes were dry, and she was incredibly calm. Family members decided that she must have been given a tranquilizer at the hospital to calm her down. In the days that followed, Lucky's Chrysler Voyager was recovered. It had been abandoned and held little evidence except for a few fingerprints, which, when run, didn't yield any result to known offenders. It was determined that the family had been shot with Lucky's service pistol. The gun was nowhere to be found. Immediately, those trying to figure out what possibly could have led to the devastating massacre looked to Lucky's work as a clue. He very well could have been targeted due to his police work. Although the investigating officer wasn't able to find any specific cases he'd worked on which may have made him a target. Then they looked at his other businesses. It's actually very common for crimes like this to result from an employment dispute. So each of Lucky's employees, both current and past, were looked at closely. Police trawled through his business records, looking for any deal or loan which could have led to Lucky becoming a target. But try as they might, they couldn't find any connection which led to possible clues. The funeral was a devastatingly painful event. Chekhovatso's baby had been removed from her womb during the autopsy, as is standard practice, and was placed in its own coffin. So the sight of five coffins, three adult-sized and two smaller ones, only made the deep pain of the family and community worse. After this, and as the investigation continued, Ontatile went to live with her aunt. She was just 15 and still going to school. She would need family support to move through her grief. In trying to come to terms with the horrific murders themselves, Ontatile's aunt and other family members found themselves struggling with understanding how the girl was manifesting her own grief journey. She spent a lot of time with her friends and at parties, and her aunt tried to find a middle ground between allowing her to grieve in her own way and stopping her from heading too far off the edge. Ontatile was the sole surviving beneficiary of her parents' estate. And although I don't know the exact details of how the inheritance worked, considering her age at the time, she would have been in line to receive all policy funds as well as assets belonging to the family, including vehicles and the house in which they were murdered. Usually minor beneficiaries of this type of inheritance will have it held in a trust for them, which pays for the child's upkeep until they turn either 18 or 21, and then the rest is paid out to them as their parents' will sets out. Ontatile, though, most definitely had access to some of this money herself immediately after her parents' death, and I'll expand on how we know this a little later. In 2017, the Sabatis' extended family and community were relieved to hear that police had made two arrests in the murders of the Sabati family. Tebogo Chidi and Karabo Mogoshi were arrested and charged with 4 counts of murder, theft of a vehicle, and several other related charges. How these two men came to be identified as suspects in this crime is unknown, because, well, as their trial would show, there was absolutely no evidence against the pair, except for confessions, which were tortured out of them. It seems that the police had arrested a third man for a different crime, and he had claimed that he could help police out by telling them who had killed the Sabatis. And that is possibly how Chidi and Mogoshi's names came to be on police's radar. In 2017, though, the family was convinced that these two men were responsible, and Ontatile and the neighbours testified about what had happened on the night of the murders in the trial. The girl had been unable to positively identify the two men as the two intruders, but it didn't seem an identification would be necessary, considering the two men had confessed. But during the trial, the men were able to prove, through witness testimony, that they'd been taken to a farm after their arrest, strung from their feet, and tortured by having the soles of their feet burned. The judge decided that there was nowhere near enough evidence to prove the men had committed the murders, and their fingerprints did not match those found in Lucky's vehicle when it was abandoned. He also found that there was a very good chance that their confessions had been tortured out of them, and therefore it would not be in the interests of justice to find the men guilty. Chidi and Mogoshi were acquitted and released. Despite their acquittal, the cloud of guilt did not shift from the men, and newspaper reports in the days that followed even proclaimed that a bungled police investigation had resulted in 2 killers going free. The Sabatis' extended family, friends and community seemed to also believe that justice had failed their loved ones, and they had to somehow come to terms with the fact that there would never be any justice for the murders, because even if new evidence came to light, the two men could not be retried for the crimes. It was over. As Ontatile neared the age of 18, she decided to move into her family's home on her own. She and her aunt had been clashing, with the girl now drinking heavily, and it would later be revealed also taking drugs. The move back to her family home was not without its own struggles, though. And Ontatile's aunt would later say the girl had regularly shown up at her house in the middle of the night, claiming that there were masses of snakes in her home. Family members would go and investigate the situation, only to find that there were no snakes. Ontatile, it seemed, was hallucinating. Her aunt often suggested that the house in which her family was murdered was perhaps not the healthiest place for her to live, and maybe they should sell it and buy something smaller for Ontatile, where she could have a fresh start. But Ontatile was adamant. She wanted to live in that house. And she pushed through and continued to do so. Living on her own was not conducive to Ontatile's healing, it seemed, because she soon started to blow huge amounts of money from her inheritance on parties, spoiling her friends, alcohol, and purchasing drugs. The girl had not gone on to study further after school and was unemployed, so the money was essentially just flowing out, and she had no way of replacing it. Ontatile was seemingly on a downward spiral. She became more and more distant from her extended family, and no one really knew how to help her. Having the privilege of speaking with family members of those who've been murdered, I've noticed that the anniversary of the murder often becomes a seminal point in the lives of those left behind. The cycle of grief often ebbs and flows around this day. The build-up to it is usually difficult, leaving them in despair and renewed grief in the weeks and months after. And knowing this makes me wonder about what happened next in this case. Because it's not just the grieving family that's observed the anniversary of a murder or murders. The offender often does too. On the 20th of December 2021, 5 years after the murders of the Sabati family, a 20-year-old woman walked into the Moyanoi police station and asked to speak with a police officer. She said she had information about a family massacre that had occurred in 2016. She knew who had killed the family, and she wanted to provide police with the information. The young woman's name was Ontatile Sabati. In the hours that followed, an astonished police officer took down the details of a shocking confession. Ontatile said that in 2016, when she was 15 years old, she'd hired two men to kill her family. She said she'd become tired of her parents controlling her movements, and she wanted her freedom. She also claimed that her drug and alcohol use meant she hadn't been thinking clearly, but she had essentially masterminded the entire plan. There are two versions of how Ontatile came to know the two men she'd hired to kill her family. One is that she met them on social media, and the other is that they're actually very distant relatives. Both may be true. Either way, she named Kagiso and Tumelo Mokone, who were themselves cousins, as the individuals who she'd instructed to kill her loved ones. Ontatile explained that she'd stolen her father's service pistol and handed it to Kagiso and Tumelo earlier on the 6th of December. She told them to arrive at the house around 10:30 p.m. to ensure that everyone was in the home. When the men arrived, Ontatile let them in and waited until she heard gunshots. She then instructed the men to shoot her in the thigh so it would look like she'd been a victim. She also gave the men her father's car keys so they could make a quick getaway. As payment, when she'd come into some of the inheritance, she'd paid 100,000 rand into Tumelo's account, and he had paid 50,000 rand of that to his cousin, Kagiso. The three had stayed in touch over the years and had taken great glee in how they had gotten away with the murders, and the police seemed to have no clue. Now, I have no idea why Ontatile actually came forward with this information. It's possible that over the years the guilt had become too much for her, and perhaps she thought she could actually get off relatively lightly by admitting her involvement. She went to great pains to explain that she hadn't actually shot her family herself, and she'd only come up with the plan. She also emphasized over and again that the men had not been ordered to kill little Quentin. In fact, she claimed she had specifically told them to leave him alive. I don't know if she thought that this would make her not guilty of murder, but if that was her thought process, she was terribly wrong. The law sees the mastermind of a murder plot just as guilty of murder as the person who pulled the trigger. And she was arrested and charged with 4 counts of murder and a host of other related charges. Ontatile continued to cooperate with police at this point. She showed them where Tumelo and Kagiso lived, and the two very surprised young men were arrested and charged as well. The young men were 23 years old when they were arrested. They'd been just 18 when the Sabati family was murdered. Then the investigating officer had to break the news to the family. The girl they had raised, after the terribly tragic deaths of their family, who they'd sympathized with and tried to hold space for in her presumed grief, was actually the one who had had them all killed. Ontatile had played them all along. A clear rift appeared in the family after this revelation. The paternal side of Lucky's family wanted absolutely nothing to do with Ontatile anymore, while the maternal side of Machepo's family was finding it difficult to figure out what the right thing to do was. They figured they couldn't just forgive and forget, but they did wonder for a while whether they should be assisting her with the legal proceedings. Ultimately, both sides decided they couldn't support her through the trial. And when she was eventually granted bail of 10,000 rand, neither side of the family offered to pay the amount. She clearly had nothing left of her inheritance either, and so Ontatile remained incarcerated. Ontatile's aunt would later say that in retrospect, it actually made sense that she had something to do with the murders. She'd never allowed herself to come to that precise conclusion before, but a few things had niggled at her. She thought that perhaps at worst, Ontatile had recognized the men who'd killed her family and was just too scared to say so. The woman said that over the years, the girl's behavior had just never quite matched up with the grieving child. They'd explained it away by saying that everyone grieves differently. But now, she knew her instinct had been spot on. She also recalled an incident that had bothered her over the years. It had happened just before Ontatile had moved back to her parents' home. Her aunt had woken up to find that Ontatile was drinking in the lounge and had left all the doors unlocked and the front gate standing wide open. She'd taken the girl to task, saying that, of all people, she should know how dangerous that was, and she was shocked at her relaxed behaviour. Ontatile had rolled her eyes at her aunt and flopped down on the couch, mumbling, "What do you think I'm going to do? Have your family killed too?" At the time, Ontatile's aunt had been shocked at the statement, but had immediately interpreted it differently than it sounded. Her mind did not go to the possibility that Ontatile was admitting to being involved in her family's murders. Rather, she convinced herself that the girl had survivor's guilt, and some part of her thought it was her fault that her family had been killed because she'd been outside when the murders had happened and the door was unlocked. Now, her aunt realized she'd been saying exactly what she meant. As the family tried to come to grips with this new horrific reality, Ontatile remained in prison while her co-accused were able to pay the bail they needed to get out while they waited for their trial to start. And as the investigating officer began to reassess the murder case from this new angle, the evidence began to support the version that Kagiso and Tumelo had committed the murders, and Ontatile had orchestrated them. The fingerprints inside Lucky's stolen vehicle, which no one had been able to match up until that point, was now matched to Kagiso Mokone. Bank records showed 100,000 rand leaving Ontatile's account and entering Tumelo's account. From there, 50,000 rand was transferred to Kagiso's account. Just as Ontatile had said. 5 years later, there was never going to be any other physical evidence that could be gleaned from the perpetrator's clothing, and the weapon was long gone as well. But the two young men had provided confessions, and so had Ontatile. And everything fits into place around those confessions. So the prosecution was satisfied that, finally, they had the right suspects. When the trial started, though, all three accused had made an about-turn and pleaded not guilty to all the charges. Ontatile claimed that she'd been so high on tip on the day she had walked into that police station that she didn't actually remember anything she'd said, and everything she'd since read in the statement she'd given had been a figment of her imagination, driven by drugs and hallucinations triggered by living in the house where her family had been murdered. Now, she claimed, she played no role in the murders of her family. The members of her extended family attending court that day were flabbergasted at the turn of events. None of them, though, believed it. They'd been shown firsthand by police and prosecutors how the evidence matched Ontatile's initial confession. They also felt, for the first time in 5 years, that they had the real truth. As much as they'd tried to pretend that some other scenario was in fact the truth, they knew deep inside them that Ontatile had been the perpetrator all along. Their denial had been protection for themselves. But the instinct had always been there. Their niece was a murderer. Kagiso and Tumelo also denied their guilt, despite having confessed. They claimed that they, like the two innocent men who'd been arrested before them, had confessed after being tortured and beaten. Unlike the two innocent men who had stood trial for this crime before them, these two had no proof. And also, there was a host of other evidence that actually proved their involvement. Kagiso, for instance, claimed he wasn't even in the area when the family was killed. But he could never explain how his fingerprints made their way into Lucky's vehicle, nor why he'd received such a large amount of money from Ontatile. Because Ontatile was now claiming that she hadn't been in her right mind when she'd made the confession, in early 2022, she was sent for a period of psychiatric observation to ensure that she was fit to stand trial and there were no underlying mental health conditions they needed to be aware of. She was cleared. After several postponements, the trial continued on in fits and starts. The three accused continued to insist they were not guilty and their confessions had been false. It was revealed during the trial that Ontatile had intended for her family to die on the night before they had. She'd been worried that with so many members of the family, her two hitmen would be overwhelmed, so she tried to drug her family in their dinner. That was why the dinner Machepo had made had tasted bitter. Ontatile had crushed up a huge amount of sleeping tablets and mixed it in with the food. When that had failed, she'd gone back to her hitmen and told them that they'd just have to be quick about it. Enter the house the next night after everyone had eaten and were ready for bed and kill them then. And they had. Earlier that night, she'd given them her father's service pistol at the gate. And when they'd arrived at 10:30 p.m., she'd let them in. It was this level of detail contained in Ontatile's statement, as well as how closely it aligned with the original confessions of Tumelo and Kagiso, that was among the evidence that convinced the judge the three were definitely guilty. On the 24th of January 2024, all three were found guilty of 4 counts of murder: robbery with aggravating circumstances, possession of a firearm, illegal possession of ammunition, and theft. The family members seated in the court sighed with relief at hearing the verdict. In handing down the judgment, The judge highlighted that although the evidence pointed to Tumelo having been the shooter, all three were as guilty as him of murder, as they'd acted in unison. As sentencing loomed, the judge had no choice but to take Ontatile's age at the time of the crime into account. She had been 15 and legally a minor. And though she'd only been charged 5 years later, and by the time she was being sentenced, she was already 24, there was no way around the Child Justice Act in sentencing. The judge could, however, still give her the maximum sentence allowed under that act for a minor found guilty of murder. And that is exactly what she did. She handed down a 25-year sentence to Ontatile Sabati for the murders, as well as a 5-year sentence for the other charges, which would be served concurrently. She will be eligible for parole in 12 and a half years. Tumelo and Kagiso Mokone did not fall under the Child Justice Act. They were already 18 when they'd committed the crimes, so they received life sentences for each of the murders. They will be eligible for parole in 25 years. In sentencing the trio, the judge pointed out how, in the victim impact statements, it had been clear that the betrayal elements of these murders, in that Ontatile had been a family member and then gone on to lie for 5 years and accept sympathy and help from her family, had only made the victim's experience far worse. It was bad enough that 4 family members and 1 unborn member had been snatched away in such horrific and senseless crime. But to know that it had all been the plan of a selfish 15-year-old child, and that she had so smoothly held on to the lie for 5 years, was beyond painful. And there's one thing that wasn't mentioned, but that I think is very pertinent. Ontatile, Tumelo and Kagiso watched 2 innocent men spend a year of their lives incarcerated for crimes they knew very well they did not commit. Those men were tortured, and their lives will never be the same. Ontatile testified in that trial. Granted, she didn't falsely point the finger at the men, but she repeated testimony she knew was a complete fabrication. She willingly participated in a trial that could have led to the lifelong imprisonment of 2 innocent men. And then she watched her family fall apart again when they thought the killers had escaped justice. Tumelo and Kagiso were watching this from afar, but Ontatile was in it. She was witnessing this travesty play out daily for a year and said absolutely nothing. As I said, I have no idea what made Ontatile eventually confess. I don't personally think it had anything to do with feeling real remorse, because if it did, she wouldn't have retracted her confession. I honestly think she figured she'd get off lightly because of her age and because she hadn't actually pulled the trigger herself. Maybe she'd seen the way her life was going, and some part of her thought that if she did this and cleared things up, things would get better for her. Then, when she realized that she was now very much alone, and she was likely still going to be found guilty of actually murdering her family, she decided to retract her confession and cause the rest of her family even more grief. I spent a lot of time considering how much Ontatile's age and possible substance use may have played a role in her decision-making. The law says she has criminal capacity. And I agree that at age 15, you are more than capable of knowing that if you hire people to kill your whole family, they are not going to spring back to life afterwards, and it is a permanent decision. Teenagers can turn discipline into something that it's not in their mind, though. I think we're all guilty to some extent of thinking our parents were out to get us as teenagers, and not always fully comprehending that, for the most part, they're trying to keep us safe, sometimes from ourselves. Also, the impact of hard drugs and alcohol abuse on the adult mind is bad enough, but it is even more devastating to a child's brain, body, and cognition. And the Child Justice Act takes all these things into account, which is why I don't necessarily think that the sentence was unfair in a legal sense. But, and there's a big but here for me at least, which teenager is capable of emotionally navigating the aftermath of the murder of an entire family for 5 years and actively participating in the unjust treatment of two innocent men without, at some point, caving? Sure, she finally did, but also, maybe even that was just strategic. It's honestly all just a bit scary. And I can't even imagine how the extended family has navigated the incredible protracted betrayal. Lucky and Machepo Sabati were well loved in their community and by their family. They were in their 40s and getting ready to become grandparents for the first time. On that night, as they watched their daughter clean up after dinner, perhaps they felt heartened that Ontatile was participating in family activities again, and maybe things were looking up. Although Ontatile claims she was outside when the shootings took place, we don't really know if she was, or if she was inside watching. I can only hope that in their last moments, her mother and father did not know how deeply they'd been betrayed. Chekhofatso was on the brink of becoming a mom for the first time. She'd been as worried about her sister as her parents had been, but simultaneously, of course, slowly shifting her attention to the baby she was about to bring into the world and start raising. Little baby Sabati didn't even get to take a single breath. And little Quentin, who Ontatile claimed she hadn't wanted dead, is perhaps the greatest tragedy of all. All he got was 3 years. Because his older sister, who he loved and looked up to, decided she wanted to be free. Lucky Sabati. Machepo Sabati. Chekhofatso Sabati. Quentin Sabati. And baby Sabati. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.